The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, friends. This is Larry Wilson for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Money Matters. Today's program is supported by Coastal Credit Union Foundation. For more information on the Coastal Credit Union Foundation, you can find it at coastal24.com/foundation. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you articles of interest from Kiplinger Personal Finance. Our first article up today, What You Need to Know About Money Markets. This article by David Milstein. Cash accounts are having a moment, thanks to the decent interest rates they now pay at long last. But selecting one can be a daunting task given the profusion of choices, from money market accounts to money market mutual funds to a small clutch of newly hatched money market exchange traded funds. The term money market has become a catch-all description for a variety of interest-bearing products that follow different rules. The offerings are vary in yield, ease of their accessibility, and to a small degree, levels of safety. In some respects, money market has become more of a marketing term than a technical term, says Ted Rossman of Bankrate.com, a website that evaluates bank products. There's a lot of confusion about this. What's an investor to do? Well, we'll try to lay out the various types of money market investments today, and all of which invest in high-quality short-term debt and are appropriate places to stash cash for short- to medium-term goals, as well as what factors to consider before you choose one. All this data is as of April the 30th of 2026. We're holding off on including money market ETFs in this discussion, however, because most are less than a year old. But if you're interested in reading more about them, there are additional articles under Kiplinger Personal Finance that's titled The ETFs, Just Keep Them Coming. First, an explanation about money market interest rates. They fluctuate, for starters, depending on market conditions and how their holdings perform. And you will see a variety of interest rates quoted. Each one offers an idea of how much your cash can earn over a 12-month period, but they're not exactly the same. Mutual fund money markets are required to report a 7-day SEC yield, which shows what the fund would pay in interest over a 1-year period if rates of the past week stay the same. It's net of fees, so investors can compare one money market mutual fund to another. Money market accounts quote an annual percentage rate, or APY, and that reflects compound interest, the return you earn on principal plus accumulated interest. That's different from a straight-up interest rate, which you also may see quoted. So let's start with money market accounts. You open these accounts at a bank or credit union. They offer easy access and may yield more than an ordinary savings account. You may have to fork over a certain amount, $100 or even $5,000, to open one. But most allow you to pull some or all of your money out at any time. Some accounts even offer check writing abilities. They're FDIC insured up to $250,000 if the bank fails. Monthly fees may apply too, unless you maintain a certain balance. Quitronic Bank's money market account, for example, requires $100 to open. There's no maintenance fee, and the bank pays the same interest, 3.8% currently, whether you have a dollar or $150,000 in the account. It comes with check writing abilities and a free debit card as well. This is really a pretty standard bank account that's being marketed as a money market account, Bankrate's Rossman says. And money market funds. You buy these funds through your broker. There are three types, distinguished largely by what kind of debt they hold. Government money market funds invest in short-term treasuries and other government securities. The biggest such fund, Fidelity Government Money Market Fund, and that symbol is SPAXX, yields 3.3%. By contrast, municipal money market funds invest in state and local government debt, which pays interest that is exempt from federal taxes. American Century Tax-Free Money Market Fund, and it's traded as BNTXX, boasts a 3.1% yield or a taxable equivalent yield of 4.1% for investors in the 24% federal income tax bracket. Some municipal funds focus on debt in a single state, giving residents of those states additional tax benefits. Schwab California Municipal Money Market Fund, traded as SWKXX, yields 2.4%. For California residents in the 24% federal income tax bracket, the taxable equivalent yield is 3.7%. And prime money market funds can hold a mix of government bonds and commercial paper, which are high-quality, ultra-short-term corporate debt. The largest prime fund by assets, Schwab Prime Advantage Money Investor, traded as SWVXX, holds 20% of its assets in commercial paper. It yields 3.5%. Generally speaking, all money market mutual funds are safe investment products, but they have some risk. These funds are designed to maintain a stable net asset value of a dollar per share, for instance. But during the global financial crisis, a money fund fell below that. It broke the buck. Regulators now require that money funds hold a chunk of their portfolio in cash reserves. Underlying holdings in the money fund can inject some risk, too. Prime funds that hold commercial paper stakes, for instance, are a bit riskier than funds that hold only government securities. That's partly why prime funds offer a tad more yield than government money market funds. But since the global financial crisis, cash reserve rules went into effect, much of the yield advantage in prime funds has been diluted. That's why some advisors, including Brian Schaefer at Johnson Financial Group, have decided prime funds don't offer enough yield these days to justify the risk. SIPC Insurance covers money mutual funds up to $250,000 in cash if a brokerage firm fails. The insurance does not cover investment losses. And factors to consider. Yield matters. But you may want to consider additional features before choosing a money market product. Accessibility. When you choose a money market account or a mutual fund, may boil down to whether you plan to hold your cash, whether in a bank, which provides arguably easier accessibility if you're moving money between household accounts, or at your brokerage firm. Either way, make sure you can withdraw any amount of money anytime you want. Some may cap monthly withdrawals. And if you opt to keep your cash at your brokerage firm, don't assume the default cash accounts earn a decent yield. At Schwab, the default fund for idle cash in the brokerage account earns just 0.01%. That's fine for money you plan to spend or invest in the next few days or weeks. Otherwise, consider moving it to a money market mutual fund or account to boost your yield. And tax consequences. The tax treatment on interest earned in money markets can help you narrow your choices. Municipal money market funds, for instance, are a good choice for high-income earners holding cash in taxable accounts. Interest income and other types of money market accounts and funds are subject to ordinary federal income tax, though most government funds payouts are exempt from state and local income tax. The exemption is government repurchase agreements, or repos, which generate income that's subject to federal, state, and local taxes, says Noreen Brown, an advisor at Summit Financial in New Jersey. Fees. Whether it's a monthly maintenance fee in a money market account or an annual expense ratio in a money market fund, investors should look at expenses when picking money market products, says Brown. Monthly maintenance fees for money accounts range between $0 and $25. Expense ratios of the 10 biggest money market mutual funds range from 0.11% to just under 1%. Truth be told, however, depending on how much you're stashing away, expenses may not matter that much. If you're investing $10,000, who cares? Says Pete Crane, who runs a data firm that tracks money market products. $1 million? Yeah, you should care. Our next article, also appearing in Kiplinger Personal Finance, keep an eye on I-bonds. When inflation heats up, these savings bonds take the spotlight. This article by Ella Vinson. These days, a yield north of 4% on a safe place to park your cash is a pretty good deal. So Series I savings bonds, which are offering a 4.26% composite rate on newly issued bonds, are worth a look. And because their interest rate adjusts based on inflation, they're especially useful if you want to hedge against rising prices. In April, consumer prices rose at an annual rate of 3.8%, the highest level in nearly 3 years. At treasurydirect.gov, you can purchase I-bonds for a minimum of $25, with an annual limit of $10,000 per person. Backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, I-bonds offer an interest rate that has two components: a fixed rate that lasts the life of the bond, and an inflation rate that resets every 6 months based on changes in the consumer price index. Together, they form the composite rate. Each May 1 and November 1, the Treasury Department sets a new fixed rate and inflation rate that apply to bonds issued in the following 6 months. The inflation rate also applies to older bonds when they reach their six-month adjustment date. The 4.26% composite rate for I-bonds purchased May through October of this year includes a 0.9% fixed rate. I-bonds earn interest monthly, and interest is compounded, in other words, added to the principal, semi-annually. A 4.26% yield is better than the rate you can get on most other low-risk places to put your money, such as savings accounts and money market deposit accounts. But you can't cash out an I-bond until you've held it for 12 months. And if you redeem it within 5 years, you forfeit the last 3 months of interest. So these bonds are best used for longer-term savings. An I-bond reaches maturity after 30 years when it stops collecting interest. The interest earnings are exempt from state and local income tax, although you usually owe federal income tax. You can pay tax on the interest each year or defer it until you redeem your bonds. Although most people choose the latter, reporting the interest every year can be a smart choice if you'd rather avoid one large tax bill down the road. And what to do with older bonds? If you bought I-bonds in 2022, when surging inflation resulted in a record-high composite rate of 9.62%, on bonds purchased from May through October of that year, you may be thinking about how long to hold on to them. They have a 0% fixed rate, and their composite rate for the six-month earning period starting between May and October of this year is 3.34%. If you don't need the cash right away, there's no rush to redeem the bonds, says David Inna, founder of TipsWatch.com, a website that tracks I-bonds. Although you could cash them in now and use the money to buy new I-bonds with a higher fixed rate, consider whether it's worth the early redemption penalty of 3 months' interest, he says. And even after the five-year mark, when the penalty no longer applies, keeping the bonds until they mature isn't a bad idea. They'll continue to benefit from compounding interest. Our next article, property tax bills are on the rise. This article appeared in Kiplinger Personal Finance. In many areas of the country, homeowners are feeling the squeeze as property taxes climb at a faster clip than inflation. In 2025, the average owner of a single-family home with an estimated value of $494,231 paid $4,427 in taxes, according to a recent study from ATTOM, a provider of property data. That's a 3% increase from the previous year compared with a 2.7% inflation rate in 2025. The study, which analyzed property tax data collected from county tax assessor offices throughout the country, found that some areas saw significantly steeper increases in average tax bills. Large metro areas that had the biggest year-over-year hikes in 2025 included Memphis, up by 34%, Baltimore, 27%, St. Louis, 11%, Houston, 10%, and Kansas City, 8%. Homeowners in the Northeast and Midwest contend with the highest effective tax rates, average annual property taxes expressed as a percentage of average estimated market value of homes in each area. Illinois had an effective rate of 1.84%, followed by New Jersey, 1.58%, Vermont, 1.4%, Connecticut, 1.36%, and Ohio, 1.32%. Many of the states enjoying the lowest effective rates are in the West, Hawaii at 0.33%, followed by Idaho at 0.39%, Wyoming, 0.4%, Arizona, 0.43%, and Alabama, 0.43%. Get the breaks you deserve. Make sure you take advantage of any relief programs that could reduce your total property tax you pay. Many states offer a homestead exemption of some kind, shielding a portion of residents' assessed home value from tax. Texas, for example, has a generous $140,000 homestead exemption for all residents, and states and localities commonly offer exemptions to certain groups, such as older adults, disabled individuals, and veterans, too. In Texas, disabled residents and those 65 and older can claim an additional exemption of $60,000. If you itemize on your tax return, you can deduct as much as $40,400 in state and local taxes for 2026, depending on your modified adjusted gross incomes, thanks to a provision in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. The deduction amount increases by 1% each year through 2029, after which it reverts back to the pre-2025 cap of $10,000. And lastly, review your assessment. When your locality sends you its assessment of your property's value, gauge whether it's accurate. Note that your home's assessed value may be some percentage of its full market value, depending on your tax assessor's rules. You can review your property's record card, typically available on the assessor's website or by request, to make sure the details are in order. If it lists, say, a higher number of bedrooms than your home has or some other mistake, getting it corrected could reduce the assessed value and in turn reduce your tax bill. Also, pull up the record cards of comparable homes in your area to see how their assessments line up with that of your property. You can use sites such as Zillow.com or Realtor.com to search recent sale prices of nearby homes similar to yours as well. If you think your home's assessment is too high, you can appeal it. Look for instructions on your assessment notice or your local government's website. And our next article, appearing in Kiplinger Personal Finance, is an interview article. This article is by Richard Eidsenberg, and this is an interview conducted with Catherine Collinson, who is the CEO and president of the Trans-American Center for Retirement Studies. What's ahead for Social Security? Bipartisan collaboration on a mix of reforms will likely be needed to keep the system solvent and benefits intact. And the first question posed to Ms. Collinson: in a recent Trans-American survey, Social Security turns 90. 71% of workers were concerned that Social Security won't be there when they are ready to retire. Does that concern you? Yes, it worries me that the looming depletion of the Social Security Trust Fund in 2033 for the retirement fund, based on recent estimates, may lead to suboptimal decision-making. People may think, I better start claiming as soon as I'm able to, which for most is age 62. That could mean a steeply reduced benefit for the rest of their life. The widespread fear that Social Security won't be able to pay any benefits is not grounded in truth. Depletion means that if that time comes, the system will be able to pay only 77% of guaranteed benefits. As long as money is coming into the system through payroll taxes, which provide the majority of funding, there will be money available to pay some benefits. Question: do you think something will be done before a cut in benefits happens? I have faith in the system. Social Security is the cornerstone of retirement income in this country. It's going to take political will and bipartisan efforts, but there's way too much at stake for current and future generations of retirees. Legislation related to retirement security has a long and successful history of bipartisan collaboration. I expect that to continue. Question: what kinds of Social Security reform could we see, and how can people prepare? We could see a reduction in benefits, an increase in the payroll tax, now 6.2% each for employees and employers, raising the full retirement age, currently at 67 for those born in 1960 or later, or a combination. When people are planning for retirement, they should be mindful of how potential reforms may impact them. If you think there might be a cut in Social Security benefits, ask yourself, should I be working longer, maybe work part-time in retirement? How could I save money or reduce my debt? Really explore the options. To address Social Security's shortfall, respondents to your survey favored increasing the earnings subject to payroll taxes, raising the payroll tax rate, and preserving benefits for retirees in greatest need. Just 22% said to raise the retirement age. What's your view? I think it's going to take a combination of methods. Of the potential reforms, raising the retirement age is the one that worries me the most. Many people find themselves forced into retirement sooner than expected due to circumstances beyond their control. Our retirement age is already one of the oldest in the world. In France, it's rising from 62 to 64 by 2030. In China, it's going from 60 to 63 for men and from 50 to 55 or 58 for women in the next 15 years. Question. Some experts think any changes to Social Security will only affect people younger than 50. I'm not going to speculate. My hope is that people already collecting benefits will be exempt from changes. It would be difficult to pull the rug from under the seniors living on Social Security. Customer service at Social Security has become a bigger problem lately, with some people waiting hours for any help. Any advice? Budget extra time and energy. I don't know that staffing shortages can be addressed overnight. In time, we're going to see some technological innovations and sophisticated tools that will really help people to plan what their Social Security benefits will look like, understand their claiming options, and get personalized guidance. AI is going to be extremely helpful. And lastly, question, are you optimistic Social Security will be in better shape on its 100th anniversary in 10 years? I certainly hope so. By then, we will have navigated through those reforms, and the baby boomer generation will be entering its 90s, and many will be passing away. With smaller generations of retirees following them, the shift should eventually ease pressure on the Social Security system. And as we wrap up our episode today, it's an interesting article appearing in the AARP Bulletin. You might never stop paying for that new car. Subscription fees come to vehicles. Until recently, buying a car meant full ownership. Pay for it, and you own it. But now many automakers charge subscription fees for extras, such as remote locking through a phone app, hands-free driving, or electronic parking assistance. Just one subscription feature at $20 a month could cost you around $2,500 for the life of the vehicle. Brian Moody, executive editor at Kelley Blue Book, says car buyers should take a technology test drive. How that technology works for you, he says, will determine whether you need to spend significant dollars extra a month. Well, we are now out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. We hope you've enjoyed listening and hope you'll join us again next time. On behalf of the North Carolina Reading Service, this is Larry Wilson. Today's episode of Money Matters is supported by Coastal Credit Union Foundation. For more information on the Coastal Credit Union Foundation, you can find it at coastal24.com/foundation. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Money Matters is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.